Welcome back, everybody, whoever you are and wherever you are and whenever you are. This is A, and you're listening to The Spiritual Bazaar, an anonymous audio cast by someone on the road to recovery while exploring spiritual paths and the mystery of life. Today, I have a very interesting guest and topic, which at first glance might seem not right up our alley, but in fact, it really is. We're talking about UFOs. And we're talking about abductions and alien close encounters. But what we're going to really be talking about is the experience that people have and that they share about that experience. So what does that mean? That means that there is a sort of spiritual revelation in some of these mystical encounters with beings from either supposedly another dimension or another world. And instead of getting into the nuts and bolts and questioning whether UFOs or aliens are real, Ted Peters, our guest, has delved into this topic a little bit differently and has decided to question what does that experience mean, rather than are UFOs real? And I think this is a really fascinating question because it begs to draw parallels between other mystical experiences from religious people in the past or your everyday person and these specific alien close encounter experiences. So Ted Peters is a theologian. He has authored, co-authored, edited, and co-edited more than 24 books. The topics range from sin and evil to the future of God and to points where science and religion clash and cooperate. Translations have appeared in Korean, Chinese, German, Spanish, Portuguese, and Indonesian Bahasa. His scholarly work's task is to subject culture to theological analysis to uncover hidden spiritual dimensions behind secular language and secular thinking. His new venture as an author is a series of espionage thrillers with an enigmatic heroine, Leona Fox. Now, that last part, I don't know if that's quite up to date. Ted, welcome to the show. What's actually your newest work?
Well, A, can I call you Alpha? Because, you know, there's a couple syllables in there. Well, Alpha, thanks for mentioning my espionage thriller. I actually plan on 5. The first one, called For God and Country, has already been published, and it mixes the question of to whom are we loyal, to the true God who is transcendent, or our country, which is a pretty good substitute God, and sometimes you got to worship both. It's not easy to choose one from the other. So that's the theme of this series of espionage thrillers. And my heroine is a woman named Leona Fox, who lives on the south side of Chicago, and she has a double identity. One is as a CIA undercover agent, and the other as a pastor in a church. So at any rate, it's been a lot of fun. But there's the academic side of my work, as you mentioned to the listening audience. And I'm concerned about, from the point of view of a scholar, just how our secular experience gives off religious valence and tries to entice us into thinking that finite and temporal and ordinary things are actually ultimate and transcendent and demanding even of the sacrifice of our lives, and patriotism is the number one candidate for that particular category. So I continue to work in that area.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's definitely a common thread between all of your works, even if the topics are different. I mean, you have Forgotten Country, UFOs, God's Chariots, which is the book that I was referencing in the beginning. You have Cosmic Self, Sacred Cells, Playing God, question mark. You love the question marks, apparently. Evolution yeah. From creation to new creation. Can you believe in God and evolution? On and on and on. I mean, you're definitely a prolific writer. And you're a professor, and are you also a minister? Do you minister at this time?
Yes, well, thank you for seeing the continuity in all these rather different topics that I address. I am a Lutheran pastor, and mm-hmm. I teach theology to men and women who are becoming pastors themselves in Berkeley at the Graduate Theological Union. And then my other foot is in scholarship. We have a Center for Theology in the Natural Sciences, and I spend a lot of time there with doctoral students preparing to be professors. And we really like to deal in the stratosphere with abstract things that, you know, the fewer people who can understand us, the better. So, yeah, I'm both one foot in the practical life of the ministry and then the other one analyzing culture as the way you've just described it. So thanks for asking.
Yeah. So the book UFO God's Chariots, UFOs God's Chariots, came out originally in 1977. Have you revised it somewhat since then?
Yes, the revised version came out just 2 years ago with New Page, and that's a publisher that Eric von Däniken and a number of the ancient astronaut theorists publish with, and it was updated. I needed to update not the theory, but the examples. I had pretty well formulated the idea that UFO experiences, both firsthand close encounters of the third kind, as well as the agenda of UFO investigators, such as you find in the Mutual UFO Network, that these had either hidden or overt religious and spiritual dimensions. But I was befuddled because in the late 1980s and early 1990s, we began to get reports of alien abductions that were very negative. And these negative reports, sexual abuse and things like that, seemed, at least on the surface, to counter the theory I had developed in 1976. So I really needed to investigate this new phenomenon or new dimension of the one phenomenon and take it into account, and that warranted then the second edition, which I think was published in 2014, just a couple of years ago. So the new edition, same thesis, expanded, in which I tried to provide an analysis that was not in the first edition of this this more negative or ominous side of the UFO phenomenon.
Well, you mentioned spirituality. Of course, that's the title of the show here, Spirit of the Bazaar. And the, I think I have, my question is, that term is thrown around a lot. So for you, what does that mean, spiritual or spirituality?
Well, it is a very interesting term because if you use it broadly in terms of your and my inner soul seeking contact with what is transcendent, God or the One or cosmic unity, then we can certainly date its onset to the city-state period about 2,500 to 3,000 years ago in what philosopher Jaspers calls the axial breakthrough. And you can see it manifested to some degree in Confucius and Lao Tzu in China. You can see it in Plato in Greece, Zoroaster in Persia, what today we would call Iran. And with Moses and the burning bush in the Bible, spirituality is a good word for that inner claim that the human soul wants to make on ultimate reality, which is both transcendent and immanent at the same time. And then it works its way through the higher religions. Christianity is only one. Into the present time. And then in the modern West, of course, we begin to secularize things, at least politics and to some degree culture and economics over the last 300 or 400 years. And for a period, the organized religions were the bearers of spiritual practices. But what has happened over the last century or century and a half is an explosion of spiritual interest outside the churches. And what I find curious and what warrants my study is that a lot of this spirituality outside of religion is scientized. That is to say, spiritual people love attaching their quest to the new knowledge produced by the natural sciences. Not everybody, of course, to be sure. So spirituality is a big word. It covers a lot. But I think at the heart and center of it is this desire that you and I have, a thirst and a hunger, that the inner depths of our soul be grounded firmly in what is universally true and what is transcendentally real, and the other things sort of, develop from that.
Well, do you think that that desire for connecting with a higher reality is innate for all people?
You know, that's really a good question, and I'm going to give you a somewhat equivocal answer. I think it is innate for the human race as a whole. Do I or you know individuals who just don't seem to give a rip? Well, yeah, There are individuals who don't. But I think the pilgrimage of the human race from looking at it through evolutionary history has been arising toward the what we might call spiritual consciousness, that finally there was a breakthrough, I think, about 2,500 to 3,000 years ago. And you and I are descendants, so to speak, of the breakthrough. So I think that you're in my inner quest is probably the product of this history. I don't think it's a metaphysical thing, but it is a product of this history. And as a Christian, I think God probably has a hand in the development or cultivation of this consciousness within us. It's indirect, not direct, but for the most part, at least. So I would say it's innate, but that doesn't necessarily mean it applies to every individual.
Yeah, I agree with you. There are people out there that you look at them, and on the surface, it seems like they don't give a rat's ass, like you said.
Right.
But then, you know, like I interviewed someone last week. He was a recovering alcoholic addict, and aside from his addiction, though, he was leading a very good life, making lots of money. He thought that he had everything going for him, and you hear this story from a lot of people who do well, you know, whether it's business or Wall Street or whatever career, and for a while they seem happy, they feel happy, and then something starts kind of gnawing away at them, and I just wonder if that itch or that gnawing to question what their purpose is or their meaning or why they're doing what they're doing, is it really fulfilling? They let that itch get big, but maybe some people, it is there, but they just continually suppress it and suppress it and suppress it because for them it's a distraction from their immediate gains. Does that make sense?
Oh, yes. I really think you are describing the kinds of people that you and I are likely to know on an everyday basis. And yes, you can hear that story, sort of confessional story again and again about even the very successful person in business and making a profit and being successful in the tasks as television advertisers would like to have us come to believe, you know, that the new car is sexy and that the new iPhone makes me on the cusp of the frontier of technological progress. Mm-hmm. And eventually, and I like to use the words superficial and profound here, all of a sudden you wake up and you realize, hey, all of this is superficial. You know, it's just like the outer edge of the ball. What's going on there in the middle? And then you look deep inside yourself and you don't see anything. There's nothing there. And that comes as a horrible shock. And I think what you and I have is a sort of innate hunger or thirst to integrate what is deep or profound in our life with what is superficial. And if we live only at that superficial level, sooner or later, we wake up and say, hey, this is a nightmare. And one of the modern words that I think is important, it really comes from Martin Heidegger, the German philosopher, is authenticity. What we hunger for is a congruence between what is deepest within our soul on the one hand, and then the professional, social, and economic life we live on the other. And if we can make those congruent, then we're an authentic person. Then we feel like our feet are our planet solidly on terra firma. And then making money and surviving and being popular or whatever has a certain grounding, and the nightmare is over. But boy, the authentic life is so hard to come by. Yet I think those people who call themselves spiritual, I think that's probably what they're after. And, you know, that's a good, healthy thing to be searching for.
Yeah, well, it's funny you said the iPhone, because I'm an Apple person across the board. But there definitely was a period where, you know, in my mind, I mean, iPhone was the best. I'm sorry, but, you know, my phone's better. My phone's better.
Listen, you know, a lot of fanatics like you.
Yeah. But, you know, at some point, I was like, what am I talking about? You know, like, how ridiculous is this? You know, I mean, personally like this phone, and that's fine. But there's nothing there to worship. But people do worship at the altar of Apple. And I think that that's sort of a scaled down version of what you're talking about. You know, they're seeking for something, but in the wrong place.
I think that, Alpha, that's an excellent example that sort of sets the paradigm for what we're talking about. I happen to be an Oakland A's fan, which is sort of, you know, I should be pitied for that because they always lose. But at the ball game, one of the A's hitters belts a home run, man, we are up and we are cheering. And it's only momentary, to be sure. It's not eternal, but it is momentary. But it is enthralling. It is a form of ecstasy. And in the moment, you feel like it's eternal. Well, once you get the car and drive home after the A's have lost one more time, you realize that this is not worth an investment of my ultimate commitment, to be sure. And I think our lives are filled with iPhones and rooting for the Oakland A's and things like that. And a good, healthy person recognizes that it's very nice for what it is, but on a relative scale, it's superficial. And wouldn't it be great if on the most profound scale, we are attuned with eternal reality and not just temporary excitement.
Yeah, it's funny you brought up the sports thing, because recently I was talking to someone about, you know, how in Europe, how intensely zealous people are about their sports teams, particularly in
especially
soccer, really.
Soccer is religion.
Well, and that's the thing, because Europe is more so secular, I think, than the United States, and generally speaking. You know, not a blanket statement here. And I feel like they sort of just replaced a zealousy for a religion or an ideology with a sport.
I think that that's true, and I had not thought about the advanced secularization of Europe as a contributing factor, but it could very well be. Another item that you have not mentioned that I think sub rosa really is very forceful is war. And war from the time of the Iliad and even the books of early books of the Bible War has been a way or a place where the human race really gets exhilaration in one form or another. Well, over the last couple of centuries, we've sought to curtail war by having civilian governments, etc. And so we've got all these substitutes for war, and I think football and soccer are in some ways substitutes for war. And so are video games and violent movies and things like that. In part, they try to sidestep war by providing something that meets the needs that war otherwise would provide. So I sometimes see in soccer an attempt to get all the thrills and joys of military victory without anybody getting hurt. It's sort of a genius of modern civilization to construct these sports. So if it turns out that it's really the case that these sports help to reduce the amount of war that we engage in, I'll say, gee, I'll take that substitute religion any day.
Sure, and but then you can never curtail. It seems like the smallest minority, if it be that, you know, of people who actually act out violently. I mean, people taking the buses from England to France. Oh yeah,
right. Or yeah, there's sometimes murders that take place at soccer games, especially in Latin America. So, I'd rather I don't. I would say I'd rather have a few murders maybe than armies going against each other and killing people by the tens of thousands.
But, sure.
Yeah, every human life is precious, and if international sports help preserve life over the long run, I'm glad for them, and it's fun.
Yeah, well, I mean, just like the desire for a higher reality, as you said earlier, it seems that there is an innate desire in a lot of people, particularly men, to act out violently in some way, to get aggression out, you know, and I feel like there's a sort of counterforce in our nature. So getting back to the book, though, because that's exactly what we're talking about, is what experiences are people taking out of these close encounters, these seeming interactions with beings from another planet or dimension or what have you? What message are they bringing back to us?
The context here, I think, contributes to our interpretation of UFO close encounter experiences. And the context is immediately after World War II. And I think that's a major contributing factor to the meaning of UFO experiences. Coming out of World War II, first of all, a lot of us just didn't want any more war. Secondly, it was science that won the war, so to speak, but it was also science that made the war so deadly. So in the late 1940s, we got this love-hate relationship to science. And on the one hand, science makes war deadly. On the other hand, it's the thing that puts an end to war. So how are we going to handle it? Well, when the UFO phenomenon, which begins in 1947 and really has an impact of significance all through the 1950s, the message you get from the visitors from outer space is really very clear. Stop testing nuclear weapons. Actively pursue world peace. And make science a tool or an ally in the process. It is rare that religion is mentioned directly, but science becomes, in a sense, a substitute for religion as the cultural highway that will lead us towards world peace. So, as I try to show in the book, UFOs, God's Chariot, the message is pretty simple. Right through the period of the great contactees in the 1950s, When you get to a different class of abductions beginning in the 60s with Betty and Barney Hill in 1962 and then up through the Pascagoula, Mississippi abductions of 1972 and into the 70s, now the message is the same, but it's a little bit more oblique. That is to say, the visitors from space will give the human beings they've abducted a physical examination. They'll discuss the technology of interstellar flight. And then it's through a strong hint that the message is, if you are evolutionarily advanced in science and technology, you are beyond war. So it was pretty much a secular message of salvation that was developed during this period. And I likened it to the prophets of the ancient Hebrews, where the prophets said to the city of Jerusalem or to whomever they were speaking, get your act together. Because if you don't get your act together, there's going to be judgment, and with judgment there's going to be destruction. And so the UFOnauts are like the prophets, saying to planet Earth, get your act together, stop playing with nuclear weapons, or else you are going to self-destruct. And by the time I got to my book in 1976, I could pretty well muster evidence to show that this was the cultural message that we were supposed to hear, even though some UFO experiences were very mystical in character, while others tended to be imbued with science and technology and all of that kind of thing. I still hold to that theory.
So the message is, you know, starting, it seems to be prominent with nuclear weapons, and you're saying the message sort of evolves. So that, for argument's sake, if I were a believer in aliens and, you know, actual communication between other entities, my argument might be, well, if I'm an older brother, if I'm a parent, you know, I'm going to be watching what the kids are doing, and as the kids are doing certain things, I'm going to step in and say, no, you can't do that. This is going to hurt you. It's going to hurt someone else. So, you know, maybe it's just, you know, rather than a manifestation of the collective consciousness of humans, maybe it's just someone stepping in when the time is right and saying, okay, nuclear weapons are bad, put them down. Okay, we kind of got through that as best we could. Okay, they're not going to blow each other up right now. And then the next issue comes, it could be climate change or whatever it is. So that would be the argument, I think, from someone who believes that these are actual encounters.
Well, Alpha, I think the structure of what you're saying is right on target, and the actual literature produced by the great contactees in the 1950s used the family metaphor, as you're suggesting, and that's one period in which the idea of the space brothers was developed. 100 years earlier, it had come from Theosophy, the Great White Brotherhood, etc. But it was brought back in the 1950s, and the Space Brothers were the older siblings who had once had nuclear weapons. They'd gotten through it without self-destruction, and now they were going to coach us in coming along. I think it's interesting that you brought up the environmental issue, because you don't see that in the 1970s, but you do 15 years later. By the time you get to the second phase of the abductions in the early 1990s, now the message is has less to do with nuclear weapons and more with environmental self-destruction. And the work of John Mack at Harvard in particular stresses that. It is also the case that John himself was strongly committed to environmental ethics, and exactly how much that was a factor in his interpretation of what the abductees told him told him under hypnosis, I don't know. But it is a good observation to show that the context had shifted so that by the time we get to the 1990s, we're concerned about environmental self-destruction in a way that 30 years earlier we were concerned about nuclear weapon self-destruction.
Well, from your point of view, what stands out? What rings the bell for you to say, okay, this is something more akin to a mystical experience?
Well, whether it is mystical for the individual or not, I am more concerned, I think, with the ethical impact. First of all, the spacelings of the 1950s or the 1990s are right in the sense that the prophets were right. We on Earth better get our act together if we're going to avoid an international war that will end all wars, or if we're going to avoid the kind of climate change that will make our planet uninhabitable. They're just right. So I think that would be the case whether God spoke it in a lightning bolt, whether someone with a mystical experience is going to come out and interpret it, or whether somebody who's even fabricating it on the basis of the zeitgeist. I think ethically speaking, it's the right message. And as a Christian, I want to say, well, indirectly, maybe God is speaking to global society through this means. Probably not the only means, but maybe other means. So having said that, then I do want to ask the question, are these mystical experiences of the type that we had reported, you know, centuries ago by Bernadette Soubirous in France or some of the other great mystics of history? And I think there's enough in common that we probably could put them all in the same category. But you know what? That's about as far as I can go. I'm not sure that I can say any more than that.
Yeah, the experience itself, I think, often sounds to me like it's a genuine experience when you hear people tell these stories or report what's happened to them. And I think you're right. I think a lot of people could have easily just fabricated it from the zeitgeist. But I do get the sense that a lot of people, they're being very truthful and that they actually had an experience.
I agree with that. And my approach, I call it phenomenology, my approach is to bracket out the objective reality question when I'm listening to somebody report their experience. And for the most part, I think they are being authentic. I actually did lie detectors for a while. Charles Hickson, for example, in the Pascagoula, Mississippi experience, which was widely publicized, I did a psychological stress evaluator. There's no question he believed what he was saying. This was not a lie. So as fantastic as it is, I have to say, okay, if he believes it, then I'm going to take him seriously. So that's been my approach. And then if it turns out that we've got a hoax going here, I'll work on that later. I won't do that first. So let's assume that these are authentic self-reports and then take it from there.
Yeah, someone like St. Francis of Assisi, you know, has a sort of communion and mystical experience of his own with his understanding of a higher power. When someone has that experience, just like some of these experiences with the UFO abductees, is it an experience, if we're looking at this strictly from a more theological point of view, isn't it an experience for them as an individual? Or, like you said, is it more God speaking through someone else to get the message out?
I'm not sure it's an either or. It could be both, because I think for some individuals, they do feel, and for good reason, feel that they've been chosen. They've been chosen by the outer space euphonauts, or they've been chosen by God. It functions virtually the same way in both cases. And then they have this profound message that they have to deliver to the human race. That's why I say it looks a lot like Isaiah or Jeremiah in ancient Israel. And I have actually theologically thought that that's true in another segment, a number of segments of society. For example, an overlooked group of people are the futurists. Back in the late 1960s and early 1970s, it was the futurists who were scientists. Arrio Pece in Italy, for example, was actually an atheist, but he preached in Grace Cathedral here in San Francisco. These were prophets because they said, you know, unless we stop this carbon emission stuff, we're going to change the climate. That's 1970. Now, here we are in 2016, and you know what? They were right. And I've thought all along that God was using the futurists 35, 40 years ago to warn our planet, and they're a parallel group to the prophets that come to us from the UFO phenomenon. Both of them have a parallel message. And I think just as God raised up Amos from Tekoa, a tiny little town in ancient Israel, to go and speak to the king, so also in any segment of our society, God can raise up prophetic voices that will warn the world, hey, if we don't get our moral act together, we're going to bring destruction on ourselves. So as a theologian, I want to say, okay, the UFO phenomenon is not unique. We can find God at work in a number of places in the culture, way out of religion, but still speaking about the welfare of the world to those of us who have some responsibility.
Well, the reason I asked you that, too, is because I have to wonder, are the people that are having these experiences, or chosen, if you will, you know, do they have a personal void, spiritual void of their own, and that's why they're having this experience, and or is it because they have a sort of a lacking of a sense of purpose or spiritual sense of identity, is it because that they have this void that they are chosen and it makes them more susceptible?
That's an excellent question. And if Carl Jung were on the program right now, he would answer yes. He wrote an insightful book in 1959 called Flying Saucers, Myth of Things Seen in the Sky. So note that's only 12 years after the UFO phenomenon had begun. And he did say this, what you had just suggested. He did say that about individuals. And at the same time, he had to say it about the wider culture. He said the wider culture, and this takes us back to the beginning of our program, the wider culture so given itself over to science and technology and economics and making a living and all of these kinds of things, that we're living on the surface and we've lost the sense of depth. And so the UFO phenomenon as a cultural phenomenon is an attempt to find that depth again. And at the same time, yes, there are certain individuals, of course, who are going to be more susceptible than others, and that may not be a healthy thing.
Well, give us an example, you know, a primary example of what one of these experiences are like for someone who has a close encounter.
Well, one that I rely on quite a bit in the book UFOs, God's Chariots is the Dick Jackson case in Fort Myers, Florida, mid-1970s. And Mr. Jackson is awakened in the middle of the night and as he about 3 a.m. and as he walks out of his home, there is this round, glowing flying saucer hovering there in the yard, and a door opens and a ladder with three steps. It's interesting that when an abductee talks to me, very often detail is very important. It has three steps, not four, not you know. So Mr. Jackson sees in the open doorway a being shorter than he is. He described himself as very tall, and waving him inside the craft. So Mr. Jackson climbs up the three steps and walks through the doorway, and he's amazed that the doorway is tall enough so that he doesn't bump his head. When he gets inside the craft, he sees a second being sitting behind a desk, and the first question he asks is, how does this thing fly?
Okay, that ends part one with Ted Peters. If you have any questions for us, you can email me at spiritualbizarre@aol.com, or you can go through the website spiritualbizarre.com, or on Instagram at spiritualbizarre, or Twitter at spiritualbizarre, no E at the end. And if you have any questions directly for Ted, you can contact him through tedstimelytake.com.